About 4 years ago, on April 25th, I woke up to a empty, quiet house. It was a Monday. Teresa had taken the kids to Virginia Beach to visit family. I had stayed home in order to preach that Sunday morning. And so I had been by myself all weekend long, no kids, no wife around, and pretty much spent the time doing what any guy in his 30s would do when he's home alone all by himself. Sermon study. You see, I was preparing an upcoming Bible study on the book of Job, and so all weekend I've been reading through the book and just trying to wrap my mind around it before I really got into the details. And so that Monday morning I woke up, I was going to head into the office, but first I thought I would do the husbandly thing and take out the trash, to go down to the dump, and so when the wife got home, everything would be neat and cleaned. And so I did that, came back to the house to put our trash cans back away, but started feeling just really, really dizzy. I didn't feel right and felt funny, really just wanted to lay down, but I had a meeting that morning in the office that I really just wanted to go ahead and get out of the way, and so foolishly I went ahead and drove into work. The meeting was around 10, if I remember correctly, and so I'm in my office and just opened up my Bible and said, okay, well, I'll do a little bit more study before the meeting gets here. And I got into Job 2, and as I started to read through Job 2 and to really break down the text, I stopped at verse 9. And I stopped at verse 9, I didn't go any further because I really had no idea what to make of verse 10. Where Job says to his wife, "You speak as one of the foolish women would speak. Shall we receive good from God, and shall we not receive evil?" In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. And that phrase, the implication of it, that we receive not just good things from God, and that God doesn't just allow bad things to happen, but that God actually seemingly sends bad things into our lives, or at least things that seem bad from our perspective. I mean, that blew my mind. You know, I've never minced words about prosperity gospel teachers, right? Those who claim that God only wants to bless you with wealth and health. I've never been very tight-lipped about my condemnation of that teaching because the Bible clearly refutes all of it. You know, opposition and suffering will come into our lives if we are faithfully following Jesus. And so I've always been very comfortable with the reality that hardship will come into the Christian life as a result of following Jesus. But what Job says here to his wife is different than that. That God sometimes may send that which seems to be evil or bad for seemingly no reason at all. I don't know about you, but I just didn't know what to make of that. And so I spent some time just thinking about it, praying through it, studying, trying to wrap my mind around it. These guys that I were meeting with, they arrived at the church, we met. And after that meeting, I still just did not feel right. And so I went ahead and I went home after lunch. You know, I admit, though, that even as I left, even though physically I didn't feel right, that even just spiritually I was still really confused. And the reason I tell you this story and I emphasize that date, April 25th, was because that very day, everything changed for the Edwards family. You see, I laid in bed all afternoon, went to bed that night, woke up the next morning, still felt funny, went ahead and went to the hospital. The ER doctor there thought that I might just be experiencing vertigo. That's another story for another day. So Teresa and I, we made an appointment to go see an ENT in Virginia Beach. We went on that Wednesday. The guy, the ENT said, nope, that it's not vertigo. I think you should have an MRI. Something else might be going on. And so that Friday evening, I had an MRI. When they're in the machine, I suffered the first of what would prove to be many significant strokes. You see, the week had begun as any ordinary week, you know, just trying to interpret, trying to understand what does it mean that Job says we must receive the bad with the good. And by the end of that week, I was a 31-year-old stroke patient in Virginia Beach General Hospital. And I tell you, friends, what a comfort suddenly Job 2 became to me. Because what this chapter shows us is that even in our hardships, even in our suffering, the God of heaven and earth is still in control. Now, that may or may not be a comfort to you right now, as we all just continue to deal with and wrestle with this global pandemic, and there are cases, positive cases that are being reported in our own community now. You may have other things that you're struggling with, and so God's control may or may not be a comfort to you, but for we, the reader of the book of Job, as the audience who is watching this transpire, it is vital that we see, friends, that even in all of Job's affliction, in all of his suffering, God is in control, and God is doing something greater in Job's life, greater in the world than Job or even we could even conceive. And so we're continuing to ask this morning the question that we asked last time in Job 1, that is, do we fear God for something or for nothing? And Job 2 really forces us to look inside ourselves and to ask, are we willing to receive the bad with the good, or are we seeking God solely for some earthly benefit? When life seems to be unfair, when life is hard, when suffering comes, will we curse God or will we bless His name? Will we accuse God or will we trust Him? For Job 2 teaches us that as we have received God's grace and favor in adoption as His children, we must gladly and humbly be ready to receive whatever circumstance, good or bad, He may give us. Now, in Job 1, we saw Job lose all of his fortunes. We saw him lose his children. He's left only with his physical health and with his wife. And we saw that the reasons for his losses, the reasons for his afflictions, was that God had suggested Job to the Satan as an example of somebody who worshipped well and pursued righteousness. In other words, it wasn't the Satan that targeted Job, it was God Himself that introduced him into this conversation. And as we'll see throughout this book, there are many reasons that God does this, that He intends to mature Job, He intends to increase his wisdom. There's also just the benefit of Job's experience for us, right? By looking at Job, anyone is able to apply the lessons, to apply the circumstances of his life into our own. And so we don't need to really rehash chapter 1 because we get an almost verbatim scene again in chapter 2. Once more, you have the heavenly assembly and the Satan comes and he enters the scene. And as we talked about last time, there's a lot that we could say about this scenario, right? Who is this Satan? Why is he present in the heavenly assembly? Why does God ask him about his whereabouts? There are a ton of questions we could ask, and there's nothing wrong with asking those questions. But, like anything, when we get so bogged down sometimes in our questions or in the details, we run the risk of missing the whole message. You remember I said last time, the opening to the book of Job is almost fairy tale-like. This author, he's presenting to us this story in such a way that we would see the main point. That God is the one who sovereignly and freely chooses Job and chooses the circumstances of his suffering. Then all of Job's hardships, God is firmly there. Which means, friends, that there is some purpose to what God is doing. Right? And so we ask, okay, God's doing something, He has a purpose, but is that purpose good? In other words, we're asking, can we trust God? Is God's, or His policies, really the best way of running the world? And we see that presented in verse 3. The Lord said to the Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? That there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, who fears God and turns away from evil. He still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without reason. Now, as we work through this verse, it's first noted, right? Again, it's God who puts forth Job. Second, that Job is described as unique in his blamelessness, in his fear of God, in his righteousness. That he is blameless and upright means that he enjoys a right relationship with God. It's not just that Job offers sacrifices and lives righteously because he thinks that God is some vengeful deity who must be appeased. No, Job enjoys communion with God in the same way that Abraham enjoyed communion with God. The use of the name here, Yahweh, or the capitalized Lord, as you see in your English translations, it indicates that Job is in this faithful covenantal relationship with God. And so as a result of that relationship, we see that's why Job fears him. That's why he turns away from evil. Right? We've got to get this order right, because that's what the Satan is questioning. Does Job fear God? Does he turn from evil simply because he's blessed by God, or because he's in a right relationship with him? We'll get to that in a second. But just first, God says that Job fears him. He has a right reverence for him, and therefore he pursues the things of God. And God adds, look, he does this in spite of his afflictions. God says that Job holds fast his integrity. And integrity is such a key issue for Job in this book. Right? Because the root of this word, it's the same as that as blameless, that he's got a right walk with God despite his circumstances. And that's going to be the central accusation that Job's friends make against him. They're going to say, Job, you're suffering because there's some sin in your life. But God is telling us right here at the beginning the exact opposite. That Job's suffering is not caused by any sin in his life. It has not been triggered by any sin. The final clause, though, that God makes here really might cause us to scratch our heads, though. Right? Because we ask, well, how is it that Satan incited God? Same phrase that's used in 1 Chronicles 21, where Satan incites David to take a census of Israel. And I think the reason that this should cause you to pause, you should really think through the implications of what this phrase means, is because it seems to be suggesting that the Satan has caused God to do something. That the Satan has actually tempted God to act against Job. And yet, James tells us very clearly that God cannot be tempted with evil. And moreover, this idea that Satan could cause God to do something, well, that would seem to undermine everything else that the Bible teaches us about God and His will being unmovable, being sovereign. In other words, this whole scene leads to a lot of questions just about our doctrine of God. And so the first thing that we have to remember as we ask these questions is again, the author of this book is employing literary device to convey an idea, right? He's using repetition, elaboration. He's trying to create this suspense in us as readers. And second, I think, though, that this dilemma is resolved when, again, we compare this passage to the one I mentioned just a moment ago in 1 Chronicles 21, because, you see, whereas 1 Chronicles 21 tells us that Satan incited David, 2 Samuel 24 says that God was the ultimate agent that led David to take the census. In other words, even though the Satan seeks to do harm to God's people, even though he seeks to attack God's kingdom and attack God's glory, we see that behind it all, God is using wicked agents to bring about his good sovereign purposes. In other words, whereas the Satan intended to harm God's kingdom, God sovereignly works through the Satan to bring about his will. In the case of David, it was ultimately to bring about submission and repentance in David. Same thing we see over in Genesis 50 when Joseph tells his brothers, "As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. In other words, here in the book of Job, we see God is firmly in control. He will accomplish His divine purposes, but He will work through created forces in order to do so. God's not just allowing this to happen. It's not happening outside of His control. He is directing these things to happen. And interestingly, His control is never questioned in this book. Job never wonders if God is hands off or not in control. He never says, God, are you real? God, you know, are you in control of this? God, are you present with me? No, he never asks those questions. And I think that this is really the issue that Christians wrestle with most concerning God. I find that as believers, we don't wrestle with the existence of God, right? We know that He's real. We know that He exists. We wrestle with the why. I mean, that's exactly where we are right now, I think, globally. I was just reading an article about these Italian doctors watching this priest come daily and daily to pray for them, to bless them, to pray with patients. And these Italian doctors all claimed to be atheists before all of this happened. That they've always thought that science was proof that God doesn't exist. But they watched this priest come and to love them and to serve them and to serve these patients. And the priest ultimately contracts the virus himself, and he's died since then. And so these doctors were telling the media that before any of this happened, they didn't believe that God existed, and yet this global pandemic has convinced them that God does exist. And so we as human creatures, Paul tells us in Romans 1, we all know deep down inside that God is real. But that doesn't help us with the question, though, of why? Right? Why is God allowing these things to happen? Why does God allow these things to happen to Job? Why does God choose Job? Why does God choose anyone at all? Why does He allow suffering? Why does He sometimes send suffering? Why do the innocent like Job suffer? And unfortunately, it's not always answers in this life. I mean, we know, you know, spoiler alert, by the time we get to the end of the book, that God is going to do something glorious in Job and in his friends. We know that God is going to increase their wisdom. He's going to accomplish His ultimate good. But why He does it in the way He does it, we never exactly know. But again, what we do know is that He has a perfect plan. And He will accomplish that plan. Right? Our world, despite the appearances right now, is not a chaotic world. Bad stuff doesn't happen by chance. It's not a matter of luck or karma or fluke. God is in control, and that is never questioned in this book. The question is, can that God who is in control, can He really be trusted to do what is best, to do what is right? And that's what Satan charges Job with not believing. The Satan says again, skin for skin. All that a man has he will give for his life. But stretch out your hand and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse you to your face. In other words, yeah, you know what, God? Job trusts you because you've always protected his health. Take that away. Take away his health. And not only will he cease to trust you, he'll actually curse and hate you. I mean, the Satan, he believes that Job is so selfish that Job's only concern is his own physical well-being. You know what? Job can deal with the loss of fortune. He can deal with the loss of his children because all he wants is life, just his own flesh. Job values his own life more than God. That's what the Satan is saying. And so God grants permission to the Satan and the attack is swift. Job is struck with boils, sores. They're so incredibly painful, they make him hideous. He has to scrape himself, we read, with broken pottery. And his shame is so great that he leaves his property and he goes to live in the garbage dump with the beggars of society. Right? Think about it. At this point, his suffering is more than just the loss of wealth. It's more than just the loss of children. Now he's experiencing terrible pain, public shame, all of it. As he'll say next week in chapter 3, his life is not worth living anymore. And perhaps most painful of all, we see in verse 9, he then loses the support of his helper. His wife says to him, "Do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die." Now, Job, how long will you hold on to allegiance to God in the midst of such suffering? Now, Job's wife's gotten beat up on quite a bit in human history. But I think we should cut her a little slack, because Job is not the only one to have endured this hardship, right? Let's not forget that she too has lost all her possessions. She too has lost her children. She has seemingly lost her husband now, who is physically suffering, living in a dump. All the calamity that has fallen upon Job has fallen upon her as well. I know, as my wife could certainly attest, sometimes it's the wife who endures greater hardship than the husband who's actually going through it. Now that, of course, is not to excuse her response. It's just merely to show that Job's wife, her response is a normal human response that, frankly, any of us would be tempted to give. Because note here, she never doubts the existence of God, never doubts His power. She knows that if Job were to curse God, that God would be just in killing him. In other words, what Job's wife is really calling for at this point is for Job to be put out of his misery. And so there's almost a raw compassion in her words. Now that raw compassion is foolishness, right? I mean, while it is human, it's not wise. But God never condemns us for the feelings that we have. The thing is that we must not act upon those emotions, act upon that reason. Because what Satan expects to happen here, what Job's wife concludes here, is that Job's fear of God is unfounded considering his losses. Right? What advantage, what purpose is there in worshiping God, in surrendering our lives to Him if there's nothing in it for us? Right? Ask that question of yourself. Probe your heart right now. Because while it's really easy to sit here and to judge Job's wife, I think many of us would be right there with her. Right, Christian? Probe your heart right now and ask, right, do I value myself more than God? Right, do we just pray? Do we read our Bibles? Do we get up on Sunday mornings because we expect to get something in return? Christian, are you trusting in Jesus just because you want to go to heaven? Or is it because the Lord of heaven and earth is deserving of your faith and surrender? Now don't get me wrong. There's nothing wrong with delighting in and hoping in the glories of heaven, in the glories of new earth, in the blessings of following God in Christ. But friends, we must never allow those things to drive us more than simply our delight in God. Because what would happen to your worship? What would happen to your Bible study? What would happen to your Sunday morning offering if you suddenly no longer had the tangible blessings of God? As we've been going through all of this, how has your worship of God been affected by it? Are you continuing to praise God, to seek Him in prayer, to find your delight in Him, while you're watching those around you, or maybe even yourself, get sick and suffer? As you suffer in isolation and loneliness, how's your worship of God going during this time? What would happen to the way that you live if the promise of heaven and new earth were nothing but God Himself? Christian, do you fear God for something, to get something, or just simply for the sake of God Himself? I just think that every one of us is under conviction right now. Because we all know that there are places in our hearts, there are places in our lives where we have turned the worship and service of God into something self-serving. We all have that tendency, like Job's wife, to get mad at God, to accuse Him of being unjust. That in great suffering, we can allow our emotions and our reason to drive our responses. But Job's story shows us that in times of blessing or in times of loss, that in humility and in holiness, we must receive whatever God gives us. We must preach this truth of God to ourselves. We must ask Him to help us manage our emotions. And that's exactly how Job responds. He says, "You speak as one of the foolish women would speak. Shall we receive good from God? And shall we not receive evil?" Now that final word likely will cause us some confusion, because as we already mentioned, God doesn't cause evil. The Hebrew word there is ra, which does mean evil, but not evil in a moral sense. Instead, it means something like adversity or trouble or bad. In other words, yes, while this word is most literally translated as evil, the idea of what Job is saying is captured maybe best by the New Living Translation, which says, should we accept only good things from the hand of God and never anything bad? Or I like the New American Standard as well, which says, shall we indeed accept good from God and not adversity? The Christian Standard Bible uses that same translation. But that should still... that should still cause us to pause, right? Our dilemma's not over yet. Sure, okay, God never does evil. He's never the cause of wickedness. But He still sometimes sends adversity. He still sometimes sends calamity. He sends things that you and I might feel are bad, that we might feel are troublesome. Isaiah 45, I form light and create darkness. I make well-being and create calamity. I am the Lord who does all these things. Amos 3 is a trumpet blown in a city, and the people are not afraid. Does disaster come to a city unless the Lord has done it? In other words, sometimes God may allow suffering to come our way. Actually, sometimes He may send such hardship. But regardless, He is still in control of it. Though the Satan has been the one to actually work through evil humans to destroy Job's wealth, though the Satan has been the literal cause of the death of Job's children, though the Satan has been the one to strike Job's body with swords, God is the one who has ordained such hardship. And that's a tough pill to swallow. That's tough. I mean, you and I, we're okay with saying God allows hardship, but to realize that God is the one who actually sends it bucks up against this idea that we've all held of God. But guys, Job 1 and 2 are clear. We're not making this up, right? God, according to His perfect wisdom, according to His sovereign will, sometimes He sends that hardship. Who knows for sure if it was Satan who was the agent to cause my strokes? Who knows if the strokes were just simply that happened as a result of the fact that we live in a fallen world and God just permitted it to happen? Or who knows if God actually sent that trial into my life for a sovereign and divine purpose? In other words, we'll just keep it personal. I believe, yes, that my strokes could have been satanic. I believe that they could have been merely permitted by God. But I also believe that they could have been sent by God. I don't think it was mere coincidence that the week I am wrestling with this very text, that God allowed or sent such adversity into my life. Now, you might think I'm crazy right now. You might be offended by what I'm saying. You might be ready to log off and say, I'm not watching this. You might think I'm accusing God of doing wickedness. I know that this isn't an easy pill for us to swallow. And it's not easy for us because we are in the habit of weakening the sovereignty of God for the sake of defending His innocence. I love how one commentator sums it up. He says, this is a hard lesson for some believers to learn. I would say for all believers to learn. Especially if they feel they have been promised health and wealth or have misunderstood that God's wonderful plan for their lives involves only pleasantness and not trouble. You see, realize, friend, what Job 1 and 2 teach us. That sometimes God sends hardship and trouble into our lives, that He may work through created agents like demons or wicked men, but He is the one who does it. And again, His purpose here is not to prove something to the Satan. After this chapter, we will not see the Satan again for the rest of this book. The book of Job is not some cosmic chess match between good and evil. God sends this hardship to teach Job something, to do something in Job's life. He is going to teach Job's friends something through this. And of course, God teaches us something through it as well. Do we fear God and worship Him for earthly blessing? Or do we trust Him no matter what, simply because He is God? See, notice that whereas Job's wife thinks that God has treated him very badly, Job finds nothing wrong with what's happened to him. It's not just that he accepts his hardship, he receives it. Receiving is an active word, right? It implies cooperation with providence, not just mere submission. Job acts in faith. But unfortunately, he's alone in doing so. And that's now where his real trials are going to begin. Because instead of finding help from his wife or help from his friends, they instead only increase his pain and his suffering. They put a greater strain on him. But that's next time. Here in Job 2, as Job has lost everything, he responds in faith. As one commentator puts it, such positive faith is the magic stone that transmutes all to gold. For when the bad as well as the good is received at the hand of God, every experience of life becomes an occasion of blessing. But the cost is high. It is easier to lower your view of God than to raise your faith to such a height. We shall watch the struggle as Job's faith is strained every way by temptations to see the cause of his misfortune in something less than God. What Job 1 and 2 show us is that true children of God must simply trust Him in faith. Faith that enables us to fear God and to worship God for nothing that we think we might get out of it. Not because there may be some benefit to us, but simply because we trust that our God is doing something surpassingly greater than what we could have ever comprehended. As Paul said to the Corinthians, we do not lose heart. Though our outer self is wasting away, our inner self is being renewed day by day. For this light, momentary affliction is preparing us for an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison, as we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. Challenge for us is not intellectually comprehending that. Intellectually, you can understand what we're saying, but honest with yourself. Intellectually, you can understand what we're saying. The challenge is really believing this. Living it, right? I mean, no doubt Job 1 and 2 might raise some big questions for us about God and the way He works. And while the Bible provides some answers to that, there's a lot that God does that's still mystery to us. I don't know what the ultimate cause or purpose behind my strokes were. We can't always answer why such tragedy happens. And the book of Job isn't interested in answering those questions for us. Job shows us that what our response must ultimately be is to simply trust God and to fear Him, because that is what He is due. And because we have faith that the ultimate good which He is working really is the ultimate good. And so, do you have that kind of faith right now? I mean, how can we learn how to fear God for nothing? This doesn't come by willpower, right? You can't just sit there and with some sort of determination say, oh, I'm just going to make it happen. No, worshiping and fearing God in this kind of way comes only through faithful surrender. Right? If you just look back to verse 3, and you look at the order of what we read there, God says that Job fears Him and he turns away from evil because Job is first and foremost a blameless and upright man. Right, get that. It's because Job knows God that Job is then able to fear Him and live righteously. It's a relationship with God that enables us to trust Him. And so the task that you're faced with today is not, well, how can I just better do it? It's more than that. The challenge that we're faced with, the task that we have before us, is how can I just simply better walk in with and know God? And the only way that you can do that is through Jesus Christ. Because despite all the adversity, all the trouble that's laid on Job, it pales in comparison to that which was laid on Jesus Christ. Because yes, here's the thing. While Job walked with God, he was still a sinner. He wasn't a perfect man. We can't say, oh, Job was completely innocent of all this, because he wasn't. The rest of the book will show us that there was a lot of growth needed in him, that there was a lot of fine-tuning and tweaking that needed to happen in his view of God and his faith. But Jesus truly was the innocent Lamb of God, upon whom God stretched out His hand and laid upon Him His holy wrath. As the prophet Isaiah wrote, He was oppressed and He was afflicted, yet He opened not His mouth. Like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and like a sheep that before its shearers is silent, so He opened not His mouth. Yet it was the will of the Lord to crush Him. He has put Him to grief. Why? God did this so that we might be considered blameless and upright and righteous before Him. Jesus suffered so that we might have a right standing in relationship with God, that then we would be able to fear Him, to worship Him, to live rightly with Him. And so hear me, the only way that we are able to receive both the good and the bad is through a right relationship with Jesus Christ. And so as you search your heart right now, as you continue to find places in your life where you fear God for something, as you search your heart and your mind and you find places where you're not seeing Him rightly, where you're not trusting Him rightly, where your faith may be absent or where your faith may be weak, see simply right now that the only answer is Jesus. If you've never surrendered your life to Jesus, may this be the moment that you do so. To say, I know that I need God. I need God's work in my life. And I believe that it's only through faith in Jesus that this can come. And Christian, make that same commitment yourself, to grow deeper and deeper in your walk with Jesus. That you may live rightly with and before the living God.